welcome to episode one of Games Every Designer Should Play, a podcast that explores what aspiring and seasoned designers can learn from some of the greatest games of all time. I'm Stuart Lilford, lecturer in game design, and I'm joined by...
I'm Adrian Mills. I'm a lecturer in game design for just over 10 years, and I'm an independent game designer as well.
And I'm David Grant, lecturer in game design, sort of 3D generalist.
Cool. And in each episode, we'll be discussing one essential game and what we can learn from it. And at the end of the episode, one of us will reveal to the others the game for the next episode. Will it be beloved by all, or could it be controversial? You'll have to listen to the end to find out. It's Adrian's turn to choose to say, I wonder what archaic game...
I think you may be surprised.
Can you play this game on an abacus?
Can we play it?
But for this episode, the game we'll be discussing is Portal. Thank you, David. Yes.
It makes it more interesting.
Yeah, it does.
Well, you two can say
just
it.
Just for the listener, I tried to get everyone to join in to say the name of the game we'll be discussing, and Adrian point blank refused.
I did.
I thought the conflict would be funny, so.
and I'm enjoying the conflict. We're discussing Portal in today's episode. And just in case you don't know, you've never heard of Portal, it was developed by Valve and released in 2007. Portal revolutionized puzzle platform gaming with its innovative mechanics and captivating narrative. Players navigate through a series of test chambers armed with the iconic Portal gun, bending space and defying logic to solve intricate puzzles. With its clever level design, dark humor, and unforgettable antagonist GLaDOS, Portal remains a landmark title in gaming history. But what can we as designers learn from it? And Adrian, since in the first episode, episode zero, you had to get in there that you were familiar with Nabacula Drop. You had to mention it. Look how clever I am. No, how knowledgeable I am.
Have you actually played it?
Nabacula Drop?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
I haven't played Nabacula Drop.
I've seen it. I don't think none of us have played
but
it.
But can you, just for, because not everyone will know, what's the deal with Nabacula Drop?
So Nabacula Drop, because Portal originally started, it was a 2005 freeware game developed by students of the DigiPen Institute of Technology. And they made this game called Nabacula Drop. This was seen by Robin Walker, who worked at Valve at the DigiPen sort of game jam sort of open session. He went back to, contacted them, gave them some advice. Then he took it back to Valve and showed it at Valve, upon which time Gabe Newell just basically hired the team. Just hired the team, just got them in and said, this is a great idea, we're going to sort of develop it further. And so they changed it from what was originally, you were a princess escaping a dungeon in the back of the drop, into what we have now with Portal, whereas you're a sort of
test subject.
Yeah. And I'll use the word test subject for the time being, I'll mention that a bit later.
Yeah.
But test subject, trying to, you know, working through a series of puzzles designed by the the sort of AI that controls this institute. So they changed the name from, obviously they dropped the Nabacula Drop to Portal, and I think that's quite important as a first point, because it shows the importance of a name. Because the name Nabacula Drop is rubbish.
Well, I think I read or heard that they chose the name because Nabacula is a made-up word, and that if anyone searched for it, they would come across the game.
But who's going to search for it?
But if you search for Portal...
Yeah, now if you search for Portal...
And it's like people...
Spell Nabacula.
Yeah, exactly. And so you go away and it's like, oh, it's called Nabacula Drop. Just search that, you'll find it. Right, you go away, you have your lunch, you go, you know, you... Nab Drop? Something? I don't know.
So
Bombastic Drop.
Yeah, so if anyone that's made a game, coming up with a name is one of the hardest things to do. Coming up with a good name is even harder.
Yeah.
And so Nabacula Drop, okay, it works. It is what it is. But Portal is much better because it's more succinct. It's easy to remember, and it describes the thing you do in the game itself.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that's sort of an important, if we're talking about what designers can learn, it's that importance of that very first, because your very first interaction with the game usually is the name. Mm. You know, you hear it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think coming up, designers coming up with an idea for a name for their game. There's lots of kind of different ways to try and do that. I remember seeing the like Double Fine documentary, I think, the one about where they made Broken Age, and Tim Schafer's going through his notebooks, and he's got like each notebooks, like pages and pages just full of names when he was trying to come up with a name for Grim Fandango, I think, and all these different variations. And then he kind of he got to Grim Fandango and he was like, that's it, I'm a genius, and he kind of circled it a million times. But again, with that, it's almost kind of descriptive as well, and very much like evocative of the game, similar to the way Portal is. You know, just that one word describes the game and what it's about. So yeah, I think that's a good point to raise to begin with. David, you were, I think, going to look, try and think about the art direction
or the art
of the
side
game.
Of things,
is
yeah.
there anything you kind of discovered or felt?
I mean, one of the main things, and it's just kind of in terms of art.
Sorry, we should mention that David's wearing a mask at this point. If he sounds a bit odd.
Either it's hay fever or I'm ill, so they don't want me infecting them.
No, so we insisted. He didn't want to put it on, but me and Adrian forced it on.
I wanted to cough at them, but yeah.
Hand him down.
I mean, with the art direction, I think the main stuff I was looking at was just kind of contrast and... like just well, even with like the portals themselves, the colors that they use, the sort of areas within the labs, the way the environment is contrasted, and a little bit of sort of environmental storytelling as well. So there's a lot within that we can talk about, I think.
The contrast thing, I think, is a good point, and I didn't think of it until you just mentioned it. But they use blue and orange, which are obviously contrasting colours.
Oh yeah, complementary colours, contrasting colours.
Yeah, they're opposite. Basically, it's on the colour wheel, aren't they?
And so. From what I can see, Valve in particular, and I think there's a level designer, Robert Yang, and he talks, he does kind of level design walkthroughs, and he plays a lot of Valve's games, kind of comments on level design of them, and he uses the term blorange a lot, games have blue and orange in an environment, because it's particularly like if you've got an environment, so there's a scene early on in Half-Life 2 in the train station where it's letting a lot of light in. It's like got windows above, so that the environment is kind of very orangey, and in order to attract the player's attention to where they need to go next, they have a blue light shining through a doorway, and so the players, it's very obvious due to that use of contrast where the player's supposed to go to next. And I think in Portal, they've you know, the two colours of the portal are blue and orange, so it kind of ties in with that.
Definitely.
Yeah, and they also stand out against the kind of monochromatic backgrounds, because it's a lot of grey, apart from those kind of reddy sort of palettes, but even those, they're kind of dark coloured. Blue and orange pop, and that's a good thing. So you want to know where, and also the use of those contrasting, so you've got the grey panels, which are what you can shoot against, which you can create the portals against, because you can't put the portals in. For those who don't know the game, essentially you so we haven't sort of described actually what the game is. And for those
we're assuming everyone that
those who don't know, so I think you have to navigate these test chambers by, you get this gun and it can eventually fire two portals, a blue and an orange one, and they kind of link, so you can move through one to another part of the level immediately. You can also utilize them to put them in ceilings and gain speed by as you drop, and if you put another one below, you'll constantly your speed will constantly increase
momentum.
Use momentum to sort of solve puzzles and things like that. So the test chambers themselves are quite gray, they're quite bland. Not only is that a sort of design choice, it was also they just reused assets from Half-Life 2. So there was, it was kind of a, you know, an economics. There's only ever 10 people worked on this game. Which is kind of incredible. So they utilize these kind of techniques to sort of enable you to do that, but by getting those bland sort of flat colors, it allows that orange and blue to pop easily in the in the environment, so you can see where you've shot them.
And I think that's really important for a puzzle game, when the main focus is the puzzles within the game. If you had like a load of sort of visual environmental clutter going around.
Yes.
It's going to make things confusing. It detracts from the actual puzzle itself. You might think there's a solution there that isn't actually there. So having that contrast between the sort of the, you know, the white panels and the black panels is, you know, key to kind of
In the original, now Back to the Drop, it's a dungeon. It's very dark and dingy, and it's hard to see sometimes. When I've watched a video, I've not played, like I said, but watching a video of it, it's like hard to see where can you shoot. It's not clear. And I think that's one of the clarity of being able to read the environment around you quite clearly and quite quickly that you can do in Portal, I think, is an important point aspect of the design.
Especially when you're using momentum as well for part of the puzzles. Like, you need to be able to look at something quickly, fire another portal as you're falling towards the ground. If you have a load of clutter and you don't know where to fire the portal, players are going to get frustrated and kind of confused, annoyed.
Yeah, this links to one of the things, one of the main things that I took from this, because I played the game with developer commentary on.
Yeah, I did as well.
And the one of the key things that I took from this in terms of what we as designers can learn from Portal is how important playtesting is to the development process.
Yeah.
And Portal really exemplifies this, because if you look at like early test footage of the game, they had more cluttered environments. They had more stuff in them. They weren't this kind of this like clean lab surface type environments. There was like shelves in them and chairs and stuff that you could move around. But it just kind of detracted from that puzzle experience, and players were kind of trying to do stuff with these objects instead of focusing on what the puzzle was meant to be. And the only reason that they removed it was because they figured that out through playtesting. In Game Maker's Toolkit, Mark Brown, he does a video about Valve's secret, or the secret to Valve's success, or something like that. And they are obsessed with playtesting. They playtest as soon as there's a build that you can get through from start to finish. They will put it in front of people and get feedback on it, and they will go through that process until the game is ready. And there were multiple instances in Portal where they did very specific things based on feedback from testers. So I think one of the things they mention is just that idea that these portals connect and communicating that to the players. One of the first things that you see when you look through the portal at the very start of the game, when you are first shown, is yourself, is your own character, because of the way that they are angled. As you walk towards that first portal, you see Shell. Is it Shell or Chell?
Shell.
It's Chell.
Chell. You see the character model as you're moving. And so if you stop there, that stops. Then you quickly figure out, oh, these two things are connected.
Two and two together,
And certain puzzles that they added in response to specific player testing and feedback, as you've mentioned, like the original game was more cluttered, but this distracted players and it was removed. Things like the energy ball puzzles, where the energy ball it bounces around and you've got to use portals to kind of redirect it into the plug that it needs to go
the
into
input,
the
yeah.
input. They first introduced that, as well as the hazard water in the first iteration of it. But they were like, players are getting too overwhelmed with all these different mechanics that we're introducing. And then so they added in extra ones earlier on that show, here's the water on its own, show that it will, you know, you'll die if you go in that. And then here's the energy ball on its own. And then then they show ones with multiple together. In this video by Mark Brown, GameX Toolkit, and the playtesting thing, apparently, like, when people first playtested the game, like the original game didn't have GLaDOS in it.
Oh, okay.
It was a series of puzzles.
I missed that.
And the original game, people were playtesting it, and they got to the end, and they went, wow, that was a really great tutorial. I can't wait to play the actual finished game.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, they think that there's more. We need to kind of make it feel like they've finished the game. So they introduced this idea of the antagonist, GLaDOS, throughout, that you ultimately have to defeat, because I suppose that's the language of gamers, is, well, it's a video game, there's got to be an end boss, hasn't there? And so kind of ties in with that. But yeah, player testing and iterative design is key.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key point is, like, as developers, we don't necessarily see the game in the same way that the player sees it. Like, you're going to get players going through your game and discovering things that you never would have thought would happen, like glitches, bugs, whatever, but like the actual design of it as well. It's a different perspective a lot of the time.
And just one thing I just want to sort of just roll back slightly too is the colors we were talking about.
Yeah.
Is how they're used in the UI. You're normally in first person, because it's a first person game, and your gun, you normally just have a crosshair. But in this, you've got two little sort of arcs around your crosshair, a blue and an orange one. Yep. And when they move over a piece of scenery that you can fire a portal onto, they light up, they fill in. Again,
feedback.
Yeah, so you're, like you were saying, when you're falling at speed, you're not technically, you don't have to be looking at where you can shoot, you're just looking at your little UI piece.
Yeah.
It gives you that sort of feedback quickly and easily, you know, because you're obviously taken in the background, you don't, if you focus on them, I can shoot now.
Yeah.
And it gives you that sort of, and it links, and you sort of blue and orange, and what I think one of them light, and I think it lights up if that one's actually in the environment as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So they get a little put saying, right, you've already fired the orange one.
Yeah,
it's like outline. By default, it's outline.
Yeah, and then it fills in when one exists.
So that's, I think that those little UI elements tying in with the colours, again, is more things to sort of, it ties that whole gun UI environmental portals into one sort of cohesive whole, which I think is really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Earlier on, David, you mentioned, you kind of briefly mentioned environmental storytelling.
Yeah.
Did you want to go into a bit more?
Yeah, I mean, one of the main things that I always think about in Portal is like the sort of, what's he called, Ratman?
Yeah, the rat guy.
The Ratman dens, I think. Like you basically have these massively contrasted areas where you're kind of going through the test chambers. And you'll see, like, a panel or something that's slightly ajar from the wall. And you kind of look through and you realize that there's this whole area outside of the labs. And basically, when you go into those, you have sort of scrawlings on the wall. You have, like, little cups. I think they have, like, cans of unmarked beans and stuff like that.
Yeah, one of my favorite little details in there is that there's an overturned like PC monitor, like PC unit, not a monitor, but and it's got the fan is visible inside, and it's got like a little cooking pot on top, like they've been using the heat from the fan to cook the cans of beans.
Yeah,
I thought that was a really cool little touch in there.
Yeah, but it just kind of, it gives a little bit of flavor for the players. Like it makes you start to think, like, is there someone else here? Like, how long ago was this? Are they still here? Can I get out of the sort of chambers? Like, you know, there are people potentially living on the outside of this. It just kind of adds a lot to the story just through these little visual cues. I think there's a load of scrawlings that say the cake is a lie, like, throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, because you've got this promise of cake if you complete all the test chamber puzzles.
Yeah, and that actually became a bit of a meme when it first came out.
Oh, very much so, yeah. Like, it was internet.
It probably still is.
Yeah, it still is. Like, just the cake is a lie. You know, the promise of cake, and then you get to it, and spoilers, GLaDOS tries to burn you alive in an incinerator.
We should actually say that there will be spoilers about Portal.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. if you haven't played...
I said spoilers, so you know.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you said spoilers, and then immediately you did give them
hopefully,
zero...
Yeah, hopefully you threw off your headphones at that point. I suppose at the beginning we should say, if you haven't played this game,
go play it.
Yeah,
go
it's quite play sure. it. Obvious spoilers for Portal.
This game took us probably like 2 hours max.
Two, three hours
to get through this, and that was with the developer's commentary on as well.
And we did have the benefit of having played it before, so kind of was used to it. When you first play it, it's probably about 4 hours.
Yeah. Did anyone find it annoying with the developer's commentary where you were like, you were trying to listen to it and then GLaDOS started saying something?
Yeah. Bad design.
yeah, that's a separate podcast.
Yeah,
to design your developer commentary.
slightly different.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the narrative is sparse. Within the game itself, there's not that much, and it's delivered mostly by GLaDOS, who's this sort of omniscient AI who you kind of talking to, and who promises cake, who tells you if you get through these things, dropping sort of hints, and then as the game goes further on, the character of GLaDOS gets more, so we say, unhinged, and more desperate for you to stop doing whatever it is that you're
starts
doing.
Starts glitching and stuff as well.
And because you basically, you do break out of the test chambers, and then, and that's where it does become more cluttered. That's where the world does become more cluttered. But you also, in when you're in the test chambers, there's those windows, like the viewing windows, the lab windows, sort of the frosted windows, which give you a sort of sense that you're being watched.
Yeah.
Test chambers, of course, you would be. But then you actually get behind those and there's no one there.
Yeah. And it's that, it feels very, it's a very cool moment the first time you play and you get back, you're essentially kind of behind the scenes backstage and you access these areas that you've only seen from inside the test chambers. And there's kind of more environmental storytelling in that area with the kind of projection screens that you can kind of see that kind of give you a bit of flavor to
So you have like a meeting room with a projection screen on, and it's going through like a load of stuff that links Portal to like the Half-Life universe, I think. So it's talking about Black Mesa and stuff like that.
But yeah, the like you say, there's essentially, the narrative is, you know, you're a test chamber. There's this AI robot that's gone a bit quirky. You have to defeat it. That's it.
That's it. You know. And the thing is with it, because, and just to come back to that opening area where you start, you were saying about the first thing you see, if you get a portal and you see Shell, you see yourself in the portal.
Yeah.
One of the things they also do in that area is they have furniture. So they have a radio playing, which, you know, you can interact with. They have I think it's a chest of drawers or something, isn't it, and a bed.
Yeah.
There's something there, which is not in the rest of the thing, which obviously then you can see that through the portal, which further ties and cements. You're seeing that location.
Yeah.
Because if it was just you in another room, you might think, it's not, is it the same? But because we don't see that anywhere else, it ties that, you instantly know, oh, that's where
very
I am.
Very specific landmark.
I can see where, So it's just small, and it's a very small little room you're kind of in with only three objects, but it ties you visually to that. Aside from that, you know, you just wait, because at the start of the game, you wake up and are just told to go do some tests.
Yeah.
And that's kind of it.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really get much in the way of kind of, you know, overt narrative other than that. There's some little bits later on from, you know, obviously towards the end, but you can, you know, you can assume, you can read some things into it, maybe, if you want to read some things into the character of Chell. And one of the things you notice is she's in an orange jumpsuit, which is probably synonymous with, you know, prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So was she a prisoner?
I mean, the fact is, you start in a very small cube. Yeah, you're in a cell. You just have I think there's like a toilet, a bed, chair, something.
Yeah. So like, where did Chell come from? How did she get
there? Her name is Cell, but just with a H in it. This conspiracy.
You're going a bit too far there.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm thinking. So, you know, if you're looking at a wider sort of story, it's like, are they, you know, they're bringing in test subjects, but where are these test subjects from?
Yeah.
Who are they? Why are they? Who would not be missed?
You know, who would they incinerate at the end of a series of tests?
So I think there's that to be read. So I think you might go, well, it's actually orange, so it stands out. But I think there's maybe more to it than that.
No cake in prison, so that's a good incentive for.
I'm sure they have cake.
I'm assuming that. I've never been.
They
to
have
prison.
Birthday cakes at lunchtime.
Okay.
All the people see happy birthday
on a Black Forest gatto. Red.
But yeah, there's nuggets of narrative there. But there's the main thing that comes through in terms of narrative design, I guess, is like the writing. The writing is where.
Yeah.
So it's the characterization of GLaDOS, really.
Mm. Yeah, one character.
Yeah, because Chell is the silent protagonist.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it's that, like the things that like GLaDOS says, and also the humor in it as well. Like this game is funny. It's a funny game. There's like little things that kind of make you laugh. I don't think anyone kind of really looks at it as a comedy game. It's a puzzle game, I guess, first and foremost. But I think it's very. There is a lot of focus around certain things it does around comedy and writing. Mm. I wrote down a couple of my favourite quotes. please move quickly as the effects of prolonged exposure to the button are not part of this test. That was one of my favourite lines. And like the bit where it goes, we regret to inform you that this next test is impossible. And then just leave it at that. Just like these little nuggets. I really like the turrets.
The turrets are great.
Yeah, so we're saying it's literally just GLaDOS, but the turrets are like a little secondary character in there as well, and just the little quirky things that they say.
Yeah, because the turrets talk. They make little sounds. They're like,
"Hello,
yeah. Are you still there?
Put me down."
One of the things I didn't realize that they do is like you can pick one up, you can use it to shield yourself from being shot at. Yeah. But if you do that, they're like, "Don't shoot, it's me." It's quite funny to hear that.
Yeah.
Which I don't think I realised on like my first few playthroughs at all. But on this most recent one, I just thought, because I think they teach you can do that with this puzzle with the cube, where you've got to use the cube to protect yourself from the energy ball.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they introduce the turrets after that. And I'm like, oh, I wonder if I can apply that. Mm. And then you can essentially use a turret to protect yourself from turret fire, but they have this little exchange.
The designs of the turrets are great. It's just like a little capsule with three legs, which is like really not that stable, as you like find out by just you bump into them and they'll fall over.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the best thing to do with them is to put a portal underneath them.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Just woo.
And then drop them on top of
the ones. You can also, get the dialogue as well if you knock the cameras off the wall.
Yeah, I was going to mention.
Oh, I don't think I've got that.
If you put a portal above a camera, the camera's watching, you can put a cube through that or a portal through that, and it'll knock the camera off the wall. And GLaDOS will say something along the lines of, please don't interfere with the furniture in the level.
Company property.
Yeah.
I believe there's an achievement actually for like if you take off all of the cameras or something like that. Yeah. Mm. I hadn't thought about achievements actually.
No, I never do. I'm not interested. I went through a brief period of time where I was bothered about achievements in games. I think I platinumed three PlayStation games. They were Assassin's Creed 2, Batman Arkham Asylum, and Saw the video game.
We are talking a very specific period of time.
Interesting.
Yes. 2008, yeah.
And Portal came out.
Yeah. I didn't know that about the cameras. That's cool. Yeah. And I think in terms of writing as well, that kind of stuff where it is, there's a thing that I think is important when designing games is that you show the player their impact on
their
game.
Matter.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that's like a reaction to something that you're doing.
Yeah.
So they might have had it so that you can knock the cameras off, but then the fact that GLaDOS then comments on it makes you feel like the things that I'm doing in this game are making
it. Even though you can't see her, like you can still interact with her in some form just by knocking off the cameras. Yeah. Like she reacts to that.
Yeah. So it's that comes down to player feedback. I'm giving players good feedback for their actions at any point, and the smallest thing, the more feedback you can give to a player, the better.
Yeah.
Because like you said, they feel like they're part of the world. They feel like they're interacting with the world, but it also tells you that my actions are not pointless. And then the things that you don't get feedback for, that I don't need to sort of worry about, you know.
Yes.
So the things you do, it's like, right, focus on those. If it's not giving me something, probably don't want me to do it, and it's like not happening.
Yeah.
There's no, I'm not getting progression from that.
You're kind of training your brain, like as you're going through the game, like the way they set up all the different chambers and everything, where you get one mechanic one by one.
So feedback can be really simple, you know, in like an adventure game or something, where you control like a hand or something. You're looking at objects with the feedback. If you click on objects, but you don't know what they are, but if the hand lights up when it's over an object, you know, that's feedback to the player. You can do something that's simple stuff like that. As much as you can give to the player, I think is best.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think as well, because like I think certain games you can provide feedback maybe easier. So like I guess a first person shooter game is really obvious. Like if you shoot a thing and it explodes in loads of like blood particle effects, that's really obvious feedback to the player. But like in a game like Portal, where there's less kind of action, I guess, and it's more kind of thought based and logic based, you're still able to provide these little bits of feedback that they're doing something right. And even things like you're saying, like adventure games, we mentioned this game last episode, as one that you thought I would talk about, Dr. Langoskov, Tiger and the Terribly Cursed Emerald, the World.
Now we're talking about it.
We're gonna, yeah, because right, that's a walking simulator, and so there's not a lot of gameplay happening there, but you're still able to get feedback from the narrator, very much a similar way to the what Portal is doing.
Yeah,
because there's like a section where if you just stand on the table, the narrator yells at you for standing on the table, and this is it links back to when you knock the cameras off, you get yelled at. And it's just it doesn't matter what type of game you're making, that feedback that you can provide the player that they're doing something. It makes them, because ultimately we want to play games because we want to. It's for escapism, and we want to feel like powerful in whatever world we are playing in.
Yeah.
And even if it obviously like a shooter game, you want to feel like you can shoot all these things, and you've got loads of health, and you're really strong. And but even in something like a first person walking simulator, you can still make the player feel like they've got that impact on the world by just commenting on these things that they do.
Mm. And there's another way that. I mean, just to sort of bring in another game, which the more recent Resident Evil games do with the map. So when you collect objects throughout the world in Resident Evil, and whether that's 2, 3, 4, whatever the game has been. But the more recent ones, when you look at the map screen, if the area in the map is coloured red, it means you haven't found everything. But if it's blue, you have found everything.
Yeah.
So as you clear the map of everything, it slowly turns to blue and you clear it out. That gives you a sense of, I found everything. That's the sense of, it's a really simple thing, but it's just, it tells you there's still stuff you haven't found, go back and have a look.
Yeah.
But also when you do clear it, you feel a sense of, cool, cleared that room out. And it's only a little thing, but it's very satisfying to sort of see a whole blue and I've collected everything because as gamers we love collecting things. If Banjo-Kazooie taught me anything, collecting stuff is just it's just a thing we do.
Numbers going up, or in this case colors changing from one to another, we like that sort of stuff.
But it's that thing about we have an impact on on the world.
That's it. You ultimately, that's why I clicker games are popular idle games, because I pressed this thing and this button went from 1 to 2.
The numbers are getting bigger
and bigger, and I'm doing that. So here's a question. Are cutscenes bad game design?
No.
No?
Okay. I don't think they're bad game design. They can be designed badly.
Yeah.
So I think there's a difference. I think there's a time and place for cutscenes, and I think a good cutscene immerses you and brings you into a narrative. If you want to point that, I would look at the opening cutscene. Well, not quite the opening cutscene, but the initial sort of intro to the story cutscene of Uncharted 2. I show this sort of thing. It's the bit where Nate meets Chloe and Harry, and they sort of discuss the thing, and it talks, and you know, flipping back, and they're giving information.
Yeah.
And it's 4 minutes long, and you think 4 minutes long, but it just passes because it's a really, really well done cutscene. Then other times, sort of thing, you can have cutscenes which are just intrusive and boring, and get in the way of actual wanting to play the game.
Which ones are these? So what's the game you're referring to there? Have you got a particular one in mind?
Too many. I would say, because the majority of games where they do cutscenes, they're bad. They're in the way.
Yeah,
Need them.
Yeah, you don't need them. Or what's worse, and this is sort of an adjacent to sort of cutscenes, is unskippable text sequences, unskippable communication sequences where you can't break out of them. Mm-hmm. And especially if they come just after a checkpoint.
Yeah.
They're even worse. The original Gears of War is one I always go back to. There's a point where you first meet the Torqbow enemies, and these things can kill you in one shot. You've never seen this weapon before. These enemies, they basically light up, and you're like, oh, what's that? Thunk, blow up. And you're like, dead. Just before you meet these, there's an unskippable section where he's on the radio to someone that comes just after a checkpoint. I went through, I heard that conversation too many times.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's bad.
So it triple bills a checkpoint, unskippable conversation where you can only walk with instant death.
One shot in enemies,
with you haven't come across before. That's bad design.
Mm. So the reason I asked this question is obviously Portal arguably doesn't have cutscenes in it at all.
Yeah.
It's something I think maybe Valve try to do with their games, like Half-Life 2. There's no cutscenes arguably.
There's no cutscenes, but they trap you in areas.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're more it's more staging. It's like watching a play,
which then leads to the stupid situation. As I always play the Half-Life 2 scenes, there's that sequence at the beginning, just before you get outside. Mm-hmm. It's when you, I think, when you first meet Dr. Kleiner, I think it is.
Yeah.
And you shut in, when you first get your suit on.
Yeah.
And you shut in, and you get you've got the crowbar at that point, or maybe
you get it shortly after that point.
There's a bit where you're trapped somewhere, you've got the crowbar, and there's just this illogical situation where these scientists to try and talk to me, and I'm just running around hammering the crowbar.
Yeah.
So there's these two things that don't fit.
Yeah. No, there is that, but I would say, like, the first time I played through Half-Life 2, I would like listen to what was being said.
Yeah.
Subsequent playthroughs where I'm less interested in what's being said, I start messing around with the environment, like even earlier than that, where you go into the little room with oh, I can't remember the guy's name, but he's dressed up. But yeah, Barney, I think. And he's like, "And how about that beer I owe you?" Yeah. And then he starts having the conversation with Dr. Kleiner on the video screen and stuff. But I'm just like picking up buckets and chucking them at his head.
And the thing is, nobody comments on it.
Yeah.
It's this thing that everyone sort of knows that Gordon Freeman just does this, and we just don't just don't mention Gordon does that. It's all right. But, you know, he doesn't say much. He just throws stuff at you, but it's okay. He'll save the world.
He's throwing a book at me. Yeah, just ignore it. Don't mention it. So he'll stop.
So in that respect, cutscenes can be, because at least you're not broken out of the kind of sort of world setting. Whereas doing that,
they're not inherently bad. It's how it's used, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. That's cool.
And I think Portal does a better job, because it doesn't. You know, you can break Gladys's talking too fast if you do things too quickly, where she's jabbering on, and then it's go, "Oh, you've done that quick."
Yeah.
So that's player feedback.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's the thing that's lacking from something like Half-Life 2 is if you start lobbing a bucket at Barney's head while he's in mid conversation.
Gordon.
He probably should say something. Hey, stuck with it.
Yeah. You know,
that would be more, you'd feel more like kind of heard or seen as a player getting that feedback.
Yes.
You're like, fine, I won't tell you about what's been going on while I've been away. I'll open the door and you can bugger off.
Yeah.
It just makes me think of, like, in Skyrim, you can put a bucket on people's head and then they can't see anything, so you can just go around and steal stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I don't know if that was in, like, I don't know how that came about.
Broken their vision code.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can just do whatever you want.
And it just became this thing.
And they have arms. Huh? They have arms. Why don't you just take the bucket
off? Yeah, exactly. They're resting on a desk with a bucket on their head. And they're just like, they're like, "Oh, what do you want to buy?" And you're just going around stealing all of their stuff.
But again, that links back to player testing.
Yes.
You know, if a player tester had figured that out, they might have gone, "Well, we need an animation for taking a bucket off your head, or just like bat it away or something like that."
The thing is, though, like, sometimes those unintentional things that happen when we're making games can be really funny. Like, I think I would argue it's better that they kept it as is.
Yeah, no, or would it have been better for them to go, "Hey, stop putting a bucket on my head," and then take it off?
Yeah.
Or maybe, not even that, if they were like, we haven't got the time to animate this. Just a line of dialogue.
Yeah, that's
it. You know what? I quite like having a bucket on my head. I can't see anything. Oh, please remove the bucket off my head.
Yeah.
I've got a shoulder injury and I can't raise my arms above a certain height. Did anyone have any trouble with Portal in terms of, like, completing any of the puzzles? Did you have to look up anything?
There was one, one bit.
Oh, David did.
Right, there was one. It was very stupid. I was basically listening to the developer's dialogue, so this might not have happened if I was just playing the base game. But there's one bit where there's a load of, like, what do you call them? Like, walkways in this really tall room.
Yep.
And you've kind of got out of the test chambers and you're making your way up. And they were talking about the walkway. So I was, like, looking above, like, looking for a place to put a portal for ages. And then I realized that you just walk to the end of the walkway and there's a door.
Yeah. That's right, at the end before the GLaDOS chamber,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. But for some reason, like, I don't know what it is, but in some Half-Life games, like, you have doors that you just can't interact with.
Yeah.
And for some reason in my head, I was like, Well, I can't open this door.
Even in Portal, most of the doors up until that point, you can't open.
Yeah, and to be fair, there's not... Well, no, I suppose the cubes, you're picking them up, but there's not... Yeah, you don't really open anything up to that point.
You do open doors, because they signify different doors, because doors that have a keypad on them, you can't open.
Yeah.
Doors that don't have that, you can interact with.
I can't remember.
So they do give you that visual feedback of saying...
But I don't think it's obvious enough.
I think it is after the first couple where you see, because you go up to them and try, and you get that closed doors sound. And but then you start to see, every door I go up to with a keypad, and there's quite a lot, they're not opening.
Yeah.
And then the only ones I can open don't have a keypad.
I think I was just being stupid, to be honest.
There is that. Maybe it could have been clipped, but I think, you know, you'll either know, because you are looking at the handle.
Half-Life 2 is more obvious that those devices that are on the doors, you definitely can't open them.
Yeah.
I think my problem was that I was so used to trying to solve stuff with the portals that I was like... I couldn't see like an opening or something, so I was like, I was specifically looking like, where can I shoot my portals?
Where's the next portal location going?
Yeah,
that's fair enough.
Yeah,
I think that's another thing I kind of briefly wanted to kind of mention is tutorial kind of
tutorials in general.
Yeah, for the game, the way that or lack of specific tutorials.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, you learn to play the game through playing it.
Yeah.
And this is something that I think like Valve does really well in particular. Mm-hmm. Like even something as simple as that door thing, right? The first door you can interact with is a jar. It's not shut. It's a jar so you can see through.
I can't remember.
And Half-Life 2 is the same. The first door that you interact with, you press to open it, it's left ajar. It's not open all the way to walk through it. It's not closed, but it's just signifying, well, I guess it's showing the player that I should be able to interact with this. Mm. If this was a door, I should just be able to push it and it will open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they try that and it works, but it's teaching them that if I press this, then I interact with the door and it opens.
Yeah.
And... a lot of the early test chambers will teach you specific mechanics, like early on, they're very simple, and then they get more complicated. But they always they show you the thing, the mechanic, and how it works. They will also like persistently test that you have got that knowledge.
Yeah,
and that's like another thing that comes down to like level design and teaching the player how to play the game rather than like tutorials, like text tutorials that you have to kind of watch, or having to go into a menu to figure out or read text subtitle at the bottom that tell you how to do a certain thing.
And they also have the signs on the wall,
yes,
kind of the warning signs, which is an interesting and an amusing moment that happened to me while playing it through this time. Was the first time you come across the energy balls, and there's that little platform to the left, I think it's kind of above a water piece, so you kind of have to shoot there.
Yeah.
So I put a portal on it, walked out into the energy ball, which killed me. I sort of collapsed to the floor, clunked like that sort of thing, but my view fixed, and I was just saying was the energy ball hitting the player, killing them sign. I don't know if that was purposeful, but it's just like,
it
was perfect, but I was like, right, okay, fair enough, I won't do that again.
Yes, it's quite good, the use of icons, because it's like really simple imagery, but it's just like a black and white icon with really clear silhouettes.
Yeah, so it's like what we see on like, you know, things in the real world, danger of death on stuff with a lightning bolt and things like that. It's like, okay,
but it's like immediately obvious what is going to happen just by looking at those little icons. And then you also have, I guess, environmental stuff. You got things flying around in the background alongside that.
I had a puzzle that I, on my first playthrough, not for this episode, but when I very first played Portal, that I had to look up how to do
tell us.
It's the one where, I think it's like the last one, where the door to the chamber opens at an angle.
Oh, that one.
And you have to wait for it to open and then put a portal on the angled kind of entrance that you've got to jump across.
You've got to jump across that big chamber, aren't you? Back and forth. That took me a few goes this time just to get the timing right. I knew what I had to do.
Yeah.
But the timing on that is quite thingy. And also, I think I did it in the end completely by luck. Because I put when you get up to the top bit, you put the portal in the floor to drop through and then it fires you across.
Yes.
But it wasn't firing me across far enough.
Right.
So what I did was, because I had the portal there, I put the portal there, then dropped off. It flung me out of that portal, just high enough to drop down and give me enough momentum then to fly across. So there was like, so that worked. So
I
was quite.
I think on that puzzle, the only bit I'd struggled with was, you know, there's like the button that's like right next to the wall or something, and you have to press the button. For some reason, I kept going out of the portal and falling straight down into the.
There are some tricky ones with momentum later on, but
They said in the developers' commentary that the momentum thing was one of the hardest concepts to teach the player. But again, they don't make you watch a video about it. They don't make you read anything.
Yeah.
They just gradually introduce that to you over and over again. I think that's like one of the only instances they have that, where she kind of explains it. But they still have like three puzzles.
Yeah. In, like, the thing goes in fast, comes out fast.
Yeah.
She tried to explain that. Yeah. Fast goes in.
Fast comes out. Yeah.
Something like that. I don't know if you want to talk about the final battle.
Yeah, we can talk. Yeah, happy to talk about that.
Because I was reading around something, and there's an interview they gave in 2DC in 2008 where they did the final battle was like really originally was a really complicated fight with lasers. They called them James Bond lasers and stuff, stuff going on, and it was this big thing. But like the players were just getting completely lost in it, and it was too much, and they didn't really know what it was. Then they had a chase sequence where you were getting away from GLaDOS and all this sort of thing, and again players were just getting lost in it.
Yeah.
And what they eventually came down to, what they eventually fight is at the moment, sort of thing, is you for those, you get to GLaDOS, you have to knock these things off, and then you drop portals through, and then you get these things which then you can put in the incinerate cube. And we've talked about this before, but that mechanic has only been used at one point with the companion cube. But what they said was that in respect of that, just coming back to the way they designed it, they actually simplified it all down, and they found that just putting a timer in Basically, their comment was that putting a timer on something makes players feel that something is way more complicated than it actually is.
Yeah.
Yeah, they mentioned that, and the bit where you're going towards the incinerator when you're on a moving platform, they mentioned it in the developer's commentary. Yeah. But it was interesting because I was like, yeah, that is true, because you're on this platform and you have to, it's moving very slowly.
Yeah, it's incredibly slowly. It slows down as you get closer to the fire.
But the fact it's moving and that you have to think on the spot makes it much more stressful and
which
impactful.
They'd just done before that, hadn't they, with that sort of narrow
thing
where you have to fire the portals past the through the gaps.
Yes.
Yeah, because like all of the other chambers, for the most part, you can just kind of stand there, look around, figure out the solution, and you know, plan it out accordingly. But in that specific section, you're doing it on the spot.
But I just thought that was really interesting, that the notion that you don't need to sort of do complex stuff. You can keep it simple, but you put a timer on it, and it instantly,
just psychological.
It instantly, you're like, the player is panicked into thinking quicker, or thinking that this is more complicated than what it is. And it does come back to that thing, which I think is the thing about dropping the balls into the incinerator. Is one of the few points, I think, where I don't think they do that enough in the rest of the game.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, they could have had a companion cube.
I was going to say, it depends on the person, I would say, because they kind of make the companion cube like a little bit impactful, where it's like, it's kind of trying to make it memorable, where you're taking it around with you and you're trying to keep it safe, and then you're forced to throw it into the incinerator, which you could argue that like makes it stick in your head a little bit more, and you're kind of maybe more used to it.
But I don't know. I think, but it's just these balls. It's not clear that you've got to put those into, because you haven't seen these kind of things before.
Mm.
So there's no, you just see the incinerator and you're like, oh, do I need to put that? Oh, I do need to put that in. You'll do it. I mean, I did it, obviously, when you first play it. But I think that with everything else, like you said, they do it two or three times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get it.
Yeah.
Here it's just something like, you remember that thing you did ages ago?
Yeah. I think that was probably my least favorite part of the fight as well, because for some reason, like every time I was trying to put it in, there'd be at least one or two times where I'd try and throw it in and I'd like waited too long and it didn't fully go in, and I had to like and it kind of, you know, you get that frustration from.
I did like the writing with the one that you pick up and it's like, what's that? What is that? Who are you? Is it? Can you smell burning? Just before you throw it in.
There's another one that's like listing off like cooking ingredients. And
it's for the cake.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the recipe for the cake.
I didn't put that together.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, those bits they're all great, and they're sort of making you feel like the turrets and stuff. But maybe it's a case of like you don't mind killing them because it just reminds you of the turrets and the turrets.
Yeah.
If you'd have had to have put some of the turrets in one of those chain things to destroy them or something, that might have. Be bridged that gap.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I think having to put the companion cube in it is okay, you know, and I get, you know, obviously I'm going about the companion cube and how cool that is, and that is a good moment.
Yeah.
Although I just did it in like seconds because I didn't care.
So,
that's what it is. But I think that it's over so quickly that bit, if you don't really notice it, you just do it, that the bringing it up as the end is the kind of the main mechanic to destroy GLaDOS. It's a bit of a disconnect. They don't really teach you that really very well elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think instead of dropping a turret in or, you know, something or like one of the cameras, if one of the cameras maybe would have been it and you could have dropped a camera in, and that might have been, maybe you can actually, I don't check that. Maybe that's there, but it's not overt. I don't think it's overt enough what you've got to do in that end sequence.
Yeah. Okay. One of the things I've got left on my list is about pacing and progression.
Okay.
And it kind of, I guess it ties into that whole concept of teaching the player. There's a GDC talk by Julien Menzel, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, from Ubisoft. It's called Level Design Workshop Solving Puzzle Design. And it was from 2016. And she talks about Portal quite extensively. But it shows you that she presents this graph of essentially it's like a bar chart. I mean, each one is each test chamber, and how high it is basically the number of steps to complete a puzzle. And it always starts off with, well, there's a couple, and then there's like a few more, and then there's a few more, and then after a maybe more intense puzzle, it drops back down again.
Right.
And this links to something that I kind of talk to students about in terms of level design and pacing anyway. And I talk about Jesse Schell's book, The Art of Game Design. There's a chapter on there on I think they call it experience curves or interest curves, where basically it shouldn't, you know, the journey from start to finish shouldn't just be progressing constantly all the time, building up. You should have these peaks that then dip off to allow so after a quite complex puzzle, just give the player a more simple puzzle, just to kind of allow them to feel, have that sense of achievement, accomplishment about that more complex one that they did, and then build it up again. And I think that's definitely something that a lot of games try to do, and I've read kind of analysis of like The Last of Us and how their story and the gameplay, they kind of build it up to a certain point, then it drops, and then after like a period of quiet, and then they build it up again, and then it drops off. And even think, you know, Half-Life 2, it gets even earlier, there's like smaller peaks where it gets quite intense. You get hauled off by this guard and you go into this torture room, what's going to happen? Oh, it turns out it's Barney, and it's all right, you're safe again. And then it kind of
That sort of ties into sort of standard sort of narrative design. Whether it's your three act structure or you just build into a crescendo, and you get the Newmont sort of the fall off at the end where you get the sort of, and that's why good films build those sort of peaks and troughs as you go up. But it's always, you know, it's the hero's journey, it's all those kind of things.
Yeah.
And so we look at this kind of, you know, game design doesn't exist in a vacuum as a single thing. We like things that build to a peak and then drop off and give us a moment to take a breath, you know, oh Lord, sort of thing. The moment, you know, when Indiana Jones jumps across the chasm and he gets out and runs out, and then it's the Hovitas are there right at the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and it's like that. Or, you know, you look at any of the Marvel films, and they do it all the time. You know, the best Marvel films, they'll do these peaks and troughs. So any big action film, go watch a Mission Impossible film or something like that, and they'll have the moment where Tom Cruise is doing some crazy stuff, and then you're like, oh.
Yeah. I mean, it's not even just films and games. Like in the lecture where I talk about this concept, I play Tribute by Tenacious D. and then I go, it starts off, you have some inherent interest in this thing, and then it slowly builds, and then it drops, and then it builds up again, and then it drops, and then it gets to right at the end where you get like Kyle's guitar riff, and he's like with against Satan and stuff, and then it's the same. And in Jesse Schell's book, he talks about, you know, the idea of roller coasters and like that, you know, builds and drops, and then it ultimately gets to the thing at the end. So it's that idea of applying that to your game and not just thinking, well, you just need to build on the last thing. That's not the case. You know, Portal introduces these like breather puzzles.
Yeah.
In between these more complex ones, and then building it right up until the end.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it goes back to, you can track that back to games like Pac-Man and things like that, and Space Invaders and things like Pac-Man, which has the, you know, the power pills, which give you a breather.
Yeah.
You know, every time you're clearing a maze or something like that, but inherently in a maze, you're starting to kind of almost trapped in the corner, the tension is there, and then you get the power pill, and it's like, I have the power, and I can come back at you, and you get space, and then the ghosts just don't die. They stay there. They get put back in the middle.
Yeah.
Which then gives you that space to, you know, get rid of them for a while and have a sort of small trough again, and before they're all back out again, and they get slightly faster and they're a bit more,
forth. It'd be interesting to look at that with horror as well, because like horror is quite different. Like if you're just constantly having big scares like all the time, like it's gonna wear you down. You're not gonna get scared of it anymore. So it's like you gotta have those dips where like you sort of feel safe, so then it gets to that sort of eerie stage where you feel like, oh, something's gonna happen.
Yeah,
and you don't know, and you get those scares or big moments in horror. I don't know if we'll do any horror stuff, but
maybe. Who does? We don't know. What's coming up?
You don't know what to pick.
The last thing I had was the game design problem of getting players to look up.
Oh, yeah, that's such a real issue.
And how they tried to do that in Portal, that was one of the main issues of if they had a where they wanted the player to place a portal up high, getting them to just do that was just look up was quite difficult.
There was one bit where they had like ladders and stuff, didn't they? That kind of
drew the
gaze upwards, and they also had it so like if you touch the ladder, it just crumbled away. So you kind of understood that you can't climb.
Have a portal up there.
Yeah, you can't climb up it. It doesn't work like that.
So. I guess that wraps up our chat on Portal. I asked our community, in inverted commas, for feedback on Portal, but didn't really get much on Portal itself. I did get a couple of comments on the podcast. This one I liked. I like your podcast, mate. I agree with the fella that said Dark Souls 2 is a bit guff. And that was from Chris.
Yeah, I mean, we'll probably end up talking about Dark Souls at another point.
I'm sure we will.
I've not played any of the Dark Souls.
That'll be a fun month.
I mean, I can't wait.
Should we get him to play Elden Ring? Because that's probably like the...
In a month?
Yeah.
I'll get the gist after a couple of hours, I'm sure.
No, you won't.
We can do some co-op. We can help him out. Yeah.
He needs the proper Dark Souls experience. He needs the PS3 Demon Souls.
Oh, God.
Look, the reason I play lots of walking simulators is because I don't enjoy any challenge to my games.
But it's rewarding.
Yeah. Anyway.
The only other comment we had was from Jamie, who just wanted to reach out and say amazing scenes on the release of the podcast, and they'll be tuning in to listen to episode one as early as possible. So
I have a question, actually.
Yeah?
Did you enjoy the game?
I was going to say about that. We need to sort of wrap up about what we think of the game. I think it's a very good game.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah. Portal,
I know. No one said it, so.
Well, I guess I think when it's like a game that every designer should play, I think I'm assuming the game is good.
I mean, maybe. I don't know. We might come up with some bad games. Like, you should play it to see things that you shouldn't do.
Portal is an excellent game. I have never played Portal 2.
Really?
Yeah.
I shouldn't have been, but I was kind of talking to Adrian outside of this about Portal 2, and like they kind of expand on a lot of the concepts,
and that's what I think is bad about it, because I like things that are just a self-contained little bubble you know, awesomeness that's just there in and of itself, and it exists in its own thing, and you don't need to be explained the Rat Man stuff. You don't need to be explained why you're in the test chamber. You don't need that, because there's space, and there's enough space for the player to input their own that's why I think that's why this is, that's what GLaDOS is doing. You know, she killed everyone with the neurotoxin.
Is that too much?
I mean, there's an argument that maybe that line at the end sort of thing is maybe a bit too much, because it's like, where is everyone? Like, and then, oh, she killed everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did.
They kind of gets rid of the mystery.
Because it shuts down opportunities. It shuts down possibilities. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think me and Adrian might be a little bit different with that, because I like finding that. I don't like it necessarily just given to you on the spot, like with that comment about the neurotoxin, but I like being able to, if you want to,
you can piece
go
together
further and like start but that's to.
We mentioned the Dark Souls games, but they do so well. They give
you
all over the place. They give you the narrative. You just got to pull it.
Yeah, you can go through the whole game without knowing what the hell's going
on.
What
I did. First time. Everyone does first time.
Yeah, exactly.
You have no idea what's going
on. But if you want to, you can look into stuff, and it's the lore is still like vague enough that you can kind of.
And this pulls back to your thing earlier, where you pointed out she's wearing an orange jumpsuit.
Yeah,
that could easily tie into a theory about where these test subjects come from. And they don't have to overtly say one way or the other.
But then they expand on that in the second one and just straight up tell you.
That's what I mean. It closes possibility doors. And the possibility space is something to talk about in game design theory, about the more things you can open it, and that's in narrative as well. It's like, well, I can imagine where this came from. That's one theory. Well, someone disagrees, but they're not wrong. Because there's not enough info there too.
There's a whole industry of YouTube content that are making their living on theorizing around stuff. I mean, like Five Nights at Freddy's is a game where the amount of videos that trying to decode the lore of that series.
He's retired now, Matt Pat. He's
I think I saw that. I was referring to game theory about those particular videos, but but yes, I enjoyed Portal.
Yes,
and
it was fun.
And hopefully, if you were listening and you played along, hopefully you enjoyed it as well, and you enjoyed this chat.
Yeah.
I had one bone to pick with you, David. In episode zero, when we were kind of introducing ourselves.
Oh, what did I do?
You were basically, I think you had a bit of imposter syndrome, and you were like, I guess I was a good student. but you've had a year of professional experience you've had a number of years of professional experience in the industry, and you're a talented 3D artist.
Yeah.
So,
thank you.
I just wanted to
maybe we'll do your iconic imposter syndrome talk at some
point. I did the talk on imposter syndrome. I don't feel like I'm qualified to give a talk on imposter syndrome. I guess that brings us to the end of this episode, which means it's time to announce the game we'll be talking about in the next episode.
Do we have any speculation? Or?
Yeah, we can. I mean, I've got an idea of what I think it might be.
I have zero clue whatsoever.
Because you might go, that's what I thought it was.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm going to do.
No, what do you think?
Well, I think it might be Baba Is You.
Okay. And what do you think?
Oh, okay.
Because we've tried to. I'm very much. If you try to talk to me about Portal in between podcast episodes, I'm like, stop this conversation. This is valuable podcast content that we are wasting on the trivial hallway conversation that we could be recording. But I think you're very much. I just want to talk about this thing.
Yeah.
But the hints that you've dropped, so you think neither of us have played it.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
And that's one game I think we talked about way back when, and you've mentioned.
That's interesting because I've played a little bit.
Okay.
I haven't played through the whole thing.
But that's complete kind of guess. Okay. That's the only thing I've got.
I have no clue. I mean, you like to talk about a lot of older games, and like we were saying, like, is it something that we'll be able to play?
Is it a Commodore 64 game?
It's not an old game.
Okay.
Do you want to know what it is?
Yes.
Wait. What's the region like?
You have to say, and the game we'll be discussing on the next episode of Games and Everybody Should Play is.
Okay, and the game we will be discussing on the next episode of Games Every Designer Should Play is Cocoon.
Oh, okay,
Cocoon.
Yeah.
That's not one I've heard of.
Have you not? It's Cocoon.
It's the follow-up from.
It's basically by one of the designers of Limbo and Inside.
Oh,
yeah.
It came out last year, about September. I've just finished it. And as I was playing it, I was like, this is the next game. Because it's similar.
Don't say too much.
No. I'm going to say something.
No, yeah.
And maybe people go, because it's similar in length and sort of kind of structure to what we've just discussed, Portal. Yep. There's similar elements to that, but it does, you know, it's an evolution of that. This is a game made 15 years after Portal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so there's like thinking about it and the controls. And quite frankly, it's incredible.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I you know, there was more moments in it where I was just like, that's so clever. And the whole concept of it, if you don't know what the concept is, do you want me to say what the concept is?
Well, I've heard it discussed on other kind of games podcasts. I've not played Cocoon, but I love Limbo and Inside. I really enjoy.
You get a lot out of this.
How have I not? I'm sure I've seen it before, but it just hasn't stuck in my head. Because yeah. I know Limbo, I know Inside.
Yeah. And for those who have, if you have an Xbox or a PC, it's on Game Pass. So
yeah, have a little play before the.
I think you can get, you know, Game Pass if you don't have it, sort of thing. I think maybe the offer's still there. You can get the first month for a quid.
Yeah. Okay. So anyone gonna? Are you vetoing this, David, or are you going?
I'm all for it.
Yeah, I'm happy to play this.
I don't have anything to veto with anyway.
I think it'll be interesting for me to try and play it, and whilst analysing it for nuggets of you know, things that we should learn from it. Obviously, you've played through it. So, but neither of me or David have
I picked it because I knew neither of you played it, but it's similar in probably scope, maybe a little bit longer than Portal, not much.
Yeah.
So it's not that long. You'll get it through in a few hours.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
And even if you don't maybe get all the way to the end, you'll get the main. But it's one of those things. It's like Portal, it just builds and builds on its central premise and does that thing in more interesting and unique ways that make you just go, oh, that's so clever.
Yep. Okay, I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it. And then obviously in the next episode, David will choose.
Yeah.
We've had two puzzle games in a row, so it might be worth
swapping it up a little bit.
Might be switching it up.
Yeah.
If you're listening to this, which you are, you can play along. Play Cocoon with us and email any kind of comments or questions about Cocoon to shouldplaypodcast@gmail.com with the subject heading Cocoon, or even if you've just got general feedback on the podcast, we'd like to hear from you. Mm. I had one or two kind of suggestions for future games. I think Jamie, I mentioned earlier, suggested Spelunky as one to maybe look at.
Okay.
We'd like to hear from you. If you're passionate about game design and you've liked the podcast, don't forget to subscribe, like it, leave us a nice review, share it on whatever social media platform your heart desires, and connect with us on. It still says insert social media platforms here because I mean, I'll get around to that maybe at some point. But I'm on LinkedIn posting about the podcast. So if you want to find me on LinkedIn, you can, Stuart Littleford. Occasionally put stuff on Twitter as well, but less so these days. Have you got any either of you two got any social medias?
Not particularly.
No. Okay. Join in the conversation. Suggest games for that you'd like us to kind of talk about in future episodes.
Yeah.
I have Twitter. I mean, Twitter. I don't use it very often. This account sort of thing, but I'll probably start pushing it for this. It's Lemon Squirtle.
Lemon Squirtle.
That's always been my Twitter. it goes back. That's my old Xbox. And it's not my old. It's my Xbox login logo.
I think as a name, it's
Gamertag. It's my Xbox gamertag. Lemon Squirtle.
I think as a name, it's marginally better than Nabacular Drop.
Well, I actually have someone, one of my ex-students, drew me a Lemon Squirtle.
Is that what it is? Like your profile?
Yeah. Well, is it a Squirtle, but instead of a shell, it's a lemon?
No, it's a Squirtle. It's a Squirtle, but in yellow.
I think my idea was better.
That would just be a lemon.
Shoot lemon juice and stuff.
It's like it's come out of its shell and it's using a lemon giant lemon as a shell.
Could very well be. No,
someone send us some fan art of that, please. Someone do that.
If you find a Squirtle on Twitter, you'll see it. Or X, as it's called now. Yeah.
All that's left for us to say is thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Bye.